Welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. I'm Adam Bolton. The coronation of King Charles III and the Queen Consort is taking place in Westminster Abbey on May the 6th. Here to reflect on the meaning of the coronation, its deep roots and its symbolism, are Paul Lay, senior editor of Engelsberg Ideas, Agnès Poirier, journalist and author, and Hugo Vickers, royal author and biographer. His latest book is Coronation. So, Hugo, let's start with you. What, for you, is the significance of the crowning of King Charles?
Fundamentally, it confirms him as supreme governor of the Church of England. That's its main purpose. I think also it shows that the focus is totally on him now. So, to some extent, it's putting the last reign, the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, into a sort of historical context rather than an actual one, if that makes sense. That's the part I find slightly sort of difficult, because if I go and buy a stamp, I'm still jolly pleased to see her head on it because I was such a great fan of the Queen. But we must move on, and she would expect us to. And so this, I suppose, is the last step in affirming him as an anointed, consecrated and crowned king.
Paul, what's the significance? What should we take out of it from a historical perspective?
Well, I think there is the shadow of the Queen. It's been difficult at times to imagine anyone else being the monarch. But I think that this now enables us, the coronation, to measure the nature of the country, the change that's undergone. The monarchy will change. It may become smaller. Perhaps I think the most interesting thing will be the way in which a religious ceremony, and an explicitly religious ceremony, is viewed in what is now a largely secular nation.
And Agnès, from your perspective as a proud French woman, where does this significance of the coronation stand?
Yes, a proud French Republican. Look, it's a wonderfully multi-layered in a way. You could think that my answer will be simple or even simplistic, but precisely because the French Revolution is at the end of a long process, that is not finished today. And because French history is, like English or British history, the heir of, you know, so many adventures, so many episodes, I will actually be quite moved by it, but not because it's the monarchy, but because it's history in the making. And because we'll be witnessing something that has been gone for centuries. And whether you're Republican or Royalist, you're a child of the European history. And as a European, I think I will be profoundly impressed and marked by this event.
Well, let's talk about the event itself, the coronation, which is, as we've already heard, a Christian ritual. The rite has five elements: recognition, oath, anointing, investiture, and crowning. Paul, how historically established are those, or is this sort of Victorian mumbo-jumbo?
Well, I think you'll find a lot of people talking about the invention of tradition, trying to be a clever historian here, they'll be saying. But in fact, I've never really brought into this idea that was put forward by Eric Hobsbawm, that all the traditions to do with the coronation, for example, are invented. That's simply not the case. If we look at the first coronation of an English king, it's in 925 with Athelstan. Probably 901 even could be argued with Edward the Elder. If we look at the anointing, it goes back even further to Egfrith of Mercia, who was the son of Offa. That's 787. And a lot of this, as Agnès was talking about, is picked up from European traditions, earlier European traditions as well. The ritual of the Archbishop of Canterbury overseeing the ceremony and the bishops accompanying the king goes back to Edgar, 973, all thought up by this rite, by Dunstan, the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time. And in fact, if we look even deeper, much of this idea of the anointed king goes back to Solomon. And so we're looking back at 3,000 years, and we'll hear the echo of Solomon's anointing in Handel's famous anthem of Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet.
This anointing, which will take place for Charles behind a screen, but Camilla's also going to be anointed, but apparently live on television, is with oil from Israel, is that right?
from the Mount of Olives, which has a very nice significance because Prince Philip's mother rests in the crypt of the Russian convent on the Mount of Olives. And the reason that she's there is because she was a great admirer of her aunt and godmother, the Grand Duchess Elizabeth of Russia, who was thrown down a mineshaft in 1918. And she is a saint in the Russian church, and she's sort of in the main body of the convent. And so Princess Alice wanted to be laid to rest there. It took actually a very long time to get her there. She died in 1969, and then she actually went there in 1988. So that's a nice link, actually.
And there is supposedly a sort of supernatural element to this anointing.
Well, yes, I mean, the anointing, Wickham Legg, the great liturgical historian of his day, said that, you know, nothing that happens before and nothing that happens after the anointing reaches anything like the significance of it. Without it, the king cannot accept the regalia. In a word, he isn't really king. I mean, he is king, of course, automatically by the death of his mother, but
what does it represent, the anointing?
Well, I think it's a little bit like, I hope this doesn't sound too simplistic, a little bit like being confirmed into the Church of England, but it's at a very, very high level. And that is why our British monarchs do not abdicate, and why the European ones who aren't anointed quite frequently do. If the monarch cannot conduct the affairs of state, they can have a regency, so they don't need to actually abdicate.
Agnes, what do you make of the religious side of the coronation?
Oh, well, you were talking about the anointing, and that brought back the memory of Napoleon, who was crowned emperor in Notre Dame. We're talking about a space that is meant for political ceremonies, because on the anointing, there was a triple anointing by Pope Pius VII on Napoleon Bonaparte and his wife Josephine. But that part of the ceremony was hidden because Napoleon didn't want the public to see that Napoleon had the power given by the Pope. And the day of his coronation, 2nd of December 1804, he managed, it was like operatic. There are things that the public was meant to see and things that was hidden because of religion, because Napoleon needed, having restored Catholicism, and after, you know, 10 years had been after it was abolished during the revolution, he knew it was very important for the French to have Catholicism back in their lives, but it needed to be controlled by Napoleon. The Pope was not higher, was not above the Emperor of the French.
Hugo, who's on top, the Archbishop of Canterbury or the monarch?
Well, I would put it slightly differently. You see, I think the wonderful thing about our monarchs is that they don't choose to be there. They're chosen by God. So God is on top. The Archbishop is the conduit for the anointing.
And, Paul, there has been a temple to democratise, a big change in the way that this coronation is presented compared to 1953, going right down to this idea of a people's oath of allegiance, hasn't there? What do you make of that?
I think the Oath of Allegiance is something of a hostage to fortune, to be quite honest. The relationship really is not so much of one with the people there. It's about the relationship to God, I think. The main player, as Hugo sort of implies, is God who's at the ceremony.
It's a bit of a problem, isn't it, when, according to, you know, every survey, the majority of people are no longer religious, or certainly Christian.
Well, I wonder if it is. I mean, I think there is a thirst for a kind of magic, and I think we saw this to a certain extent in, obviously, a less celebratory way, but with the Queen's funeral, where people were rather intoxicated by the ceremony that they saw there, and a lot of people commented. And I think it's fair enough that the Church of England is not a hugely fundamental church. It's one about the language that we inherit, the rituals we inherit, the monarchs we inherit. And I think there's also an aspect of sacred monarchy that allows for the flaws of a king or a queen as well. I mean, this goes back to Old Testament ideas of David, say, for instance, great king of Israel, who was both an adulterer, there might be some comments there, and a murderer of Uriah and his affair with Bathsheba, of course. So there's this kind of forgiveness, there's this idea of humility that's there when the king subjects himself before God. So I think there is something there that is intoxicating. There are deep truths there, whether one is Christian or anything else. I think that's why monarchy, there's something about monarchy that still really fascinates people, not just ceremonies like this coronation, but think of the power of Game of Thrones, Think of Lord of the Rings. I mean, think of The Lion King, for goodness, and this idea of Simba's hereditary duty. There seems to be something that absolutely fascinates people about this.
Of course, against that, there was Badgett's advice not to let daylight in on the mystery.
Well, there's going to be a certain amount of mystery still. I mean, I'm rather disappointed that we aren't going to get the Knights of the Garter with the golden canopy for the anointing, because that was such a wonderful moment as they came forward. But we've got this screen, and it's quite right that we shouldn't see it. I mean, I was terrified that they were going to say, oh, well, let's see him being anointed, because it just, you know, we don't have to see everything. And it just makes it more significant.
But he does actually strip down. He has to, doesn't he?
Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens. We still don't exactly know what he's going to be wearing underneath. They say a uniform, but I think things change. He'll certainly be wearing the super tunica and the collobium sindonis after the anointing, which are those wonderful gold robes which are kept in the Tower of London. So he'll look pretty splendid by that stage. But as you know, with the Queen, and that's the only thing I can really tell you about, they placed a white sort of linen gown over her coronation gown. So it looked all very simple and removed all the train and the garter collar and all the other things in the circlet. So, yeah, there's a simplicity.
And anointing Camilla is a first, I understand, is that
no,
right?
No, no, no. The Queen Mother was anointed as Queen Elizabeth right, and okay. Queen Mary. They actually had a canopy with four duchesses. Now, you can see why they didn't do that anymore. The aristocracy has been completely sidelined as far as this coronation's concerned. Think that they, in 1953, occupied both the north and south transept of the Abbey completely. Not this time.
What else have they done to bring it more down to earth? I mean, there was lots of talk of a streamlined coronation, wasn't there?
Well, it's much shorter, and that's going to be interesting to see how they get away with that, because in 1953, it was said 3 hours and 20 minutes pared the thing down to about as tight as you could get it, and it's now going to be down to 2 hours. And the King's also, he's a man, a stylish fellow. You know, he's commissioned a lot of music. Apparently, people sort of hope he won't meet any more composers, or, you know, that they were rather hoping he wouldn't as time was going on, so it's set in stone now. But he was composing all sorts of things, and it'll be interesting to see how they can get it down to 2 hours. They also have, of course, the faith leaders, so that whereas after the Queen was crowned, it was just the Archbishop of Canterbury who gave a blessing. You've got a raft of different faith leaders doing that.
And yes, you think this is going to hold much of an audience internationally?
Well, of course. It will be huge. The same way as the death of Queen Elizabeth impacted the whole world. You know, President Macron of France was... I was surprised of how in tune he was with our British friends. You know, do you remember when he addressed, actually, the British saying, for you, she was your queen, for us, she was the queen. But I think he was probably speaking on the behalf of the whole world. And it will be the same with the coronation, except it's obviously less solemn in the sense that it's more cheerful because he's about to become a king, and he might have a good impact on Britain, especially after the dreary years after Brexit. And he might prove to be a very good monarch and play his constitutional role, perhaps even more than she did.
Presumably President Macron won't join in the People's Oath of Allegiance.
No, and I wouldn't want him to do that either. We can be friends, and, you know, it's like Napoleon not wanting to be seen as a subject of the church. We do our things our own way, but we admire how it is also done elsewhere. But President Macron is coming because he knows how important this is. Whereas Joe Biden is not coming, he's sending his wife. And other head of states and leaders, I think, they don't know how to read the public's mood if they are not coming or just sending spouses or prime ministers, because I think this is a historical moment for perhaps not the world, but certainly for European history.
I think I'm right in understanding, Hugo, that when it comes to the President of the United States, they've never come.
No, they haven't. And actually, no head of state has normally come. The government has decided that this is what they want. And it's wonderful that President Macron is coming because, of course, as you know, events like a coronation are an opportunity for world leaders to meet because they've come to an event such as a coronation. But if there's anything they want to discuss, there they are. So it's wonderful that he's coming to this occasion. But certainly, I mean, in times gone by, there were no other kings and queens and no other presidents or anything. But it's like in the United States, they sent General Marshall, and the kings of Europe sent a crown prince. That was how it was, partly, I think, so as not to upstage the monarch, the British monarch.
Paul, you've written a great deal about the English Revolution, your book Providence Lost, The Rise and Fall of Oliver Cromwell's Protectorate. How important is maintaining this historic tradition that you've been talked about as a way of justifying hereditary monarchy?
It's difficult to say. I mean, we have the continuity, I would argue, because there was a break with that continuity. And we were taught a lesson when Charles I was executed, and there was a great failure to establish any other form of government, that indeed you ended up in the Protectorate, ultimately, with a quasi-monarchy anyway. A written constitution was slightly different. But I think
he was actually offered the crown by some people.
He was offered the crown. He turned it down on providential reasons, that God had withdrawn it and he would not build Jericho again, as he put it. But I think we see a transition there. One of the interesting things about Cromwell, for example, was his great hero was Elizabeth I. And I think we see a big difference between the relationship of the monarchy with Elizabeth I and the Stuarts, in the sense that the Elizabethan monarchy was essentially a covenant. It was a bond between the monarch and the people. Whereas I think, for reasons that have a lot to do with Scottish politics and the lack of power that Scottish kings had under the Presbyterian system, the Stuarts, James I and ultimately Charles I, were rather seduced by the idea of divine right, by the idea of European absolutism. And this just didn't fit very well, because I think we have, unlike France had, for example, a very small nobility that had always had to rub along with the commons and the king, and it was essentially contractual. And I think what you see over the period between the Civil War and ultimately the Glorious Revolution, as some call it, in 1688, is ultimately the kind of thing that many people on the parliamentary side in the Civil Wars were fighting for, which is the crown in Parliament. There weren't that many Republicans fighting in the Civil War. They wanted a crown in Parliament, which is ultimately, in 1688 and beyond, what they got and what remains today.
And Annis, of course, France, they had a revolution, got rid of the monarchy, and then they did bring it back several times.
Oh, yes. You know, the French Revolution, if it had gone according to plan, we would have ended up, like you, with a constitutional monarchy, parliamentary monarchy, and in effect a democracy, with a monarch that would agree not to use their power. But it went wrong. In a way, you could say. It's one way of looking at it. And since, we've had 11 different political regimes, including empires and republics, five of them, and also Vichy of sad memory. And all the while, the British royal family was just learning how to perfect croquet. So our histories are different, and yet we have still, you know, the pomp. Very often the British media sort of claim that a French president is in fact a hidden monarch. And I think there's something into it. Because if you look at the pomp, France does it also very well. It's just Republican. But when a French president wants to gather both chambers, very often he does a congress where in Versailles. It's like after Notre Dame as fire, a lot of people were incredibly upset, because below the surface of secularism, you have hundreds of years of Christian history. So it's always there in the back of our mind, or even in our DNA, even though we are staunch Republicans.
Hugo, what about the shocks, the more recent shocks in the last 100 years or so that the British monarchy has undergone? Obviously, there was the abdication, and there was also the death of Diana, which was pretty traumatic.
Well, the abdication, of course, is interesting, because whatever you think about Edward VIII, he kind of knew that if he took the coronation oath, he wouldn't be able to marry Mrs. Simpson. So to his credit, he went before the coronation. So that's an exception, obviously, because he was never anointed, he was never crowned. I sometimes in my talk show a picture, because the Illustrated London News concocted a wonderful portrait of him in his coronation robes. And then, whoops, you know, all of a sudden, he wasn't going to be wearing them. I've got
a coronation mug somewhere.
Yeah, there are quite a lot of those around. But in this particular case, all they did was to snip off the head of Edward VIII and apply the head of George VI to exactly the same picture, which shows how smoothly you can do these transitions. But that was, of course, a big moment and a very difficult one. And the new king and queen, as you know, were very nervous as to whether they would be accepted or not. The Archbishop of the day, Cosmo Gordon Lang, found them much more receptive to the coronation than Edward VIII had been. And they were, of course, profoundly moved by the whole process. It's very often the case that the monarch goes into Westminster Abbey as one person and kind of comes out as a different person. And I'm sure that'll be the case with King Charles because he's a very spiritual man. So as for the death of Diana, well, of course, yes, again, that was awful. And the whole thing was, I mean, it was a terrible decade, really. I think the skill of the Queen and Prince Philip, particularly the Queen maybe, was that she just kept going straight ahead and did not listen to spin doctors, and she had a very clear vision of what it was to be our Queen, and I think that saw her through.
Paul, though, now, rather than an abdication, we've got a divorced man marrying a divorced woman.
Well, we're rather forgiving, I think. He's hardly atypical in that sense of the average Briton, I would say. And again, it goes back to this idea of divine election. They are human and they have the same faults as everyone else and seek the same forgiveness. I think since George III, possibly, there's been an emphasis on the successful monarchs, of this idea of duty and discretion and dignity as some kind of ideal. Now, many haven't lived up to it, but I think it's interesting that George VI really embodied those kind of virtues and he passed them on to his daughter. I mean, the Queen was hugely dignified, hugely discreet, extremely skilled at what she did, and there wasn't too much light shone on her. You know, she had that public face. She could have a joke like was in the Olympics, for example. She became loved. But I think one of the real attributes that the monarchy has is it's very, very old. And you change that kind of thing at your peril, as we discovered in the 1650s.
Of course, Charles is quite old. He's over 70. Yeah. Agnes, what do you make of Charles?
Well, he's certainly, you know, I'm thinking about Edward VII, the British king that perhaps you don't like so much in Britain, but we love him. We have a fond memory of him spending a lot of time in France.
The playboy king in the Riviera.
Well, yes, but he was also a diplomat, and he obviously, like Charles, became king quite late in life, being the son of Victoria. You know, all his time being a playboy, as you say, Adam, he also learned quite a lot about Europe and Europeans, and he was, well, at least that's the French point of view, a fine diplomat. We owe him, in a way, the Entente Cordiale at a moment when it was crucial. So don't be too harsh on your kings. And so Charles may end up being a very good king. We'll see.
I mean, he appears to be a bit of a Europhile. Wanted to come to France on his first visit, went to Germany, speaks both languages.
Yes, you know, you could say he's also very much European through his father. And there's a long German connection with his family. He's not more a Europhile than Edward VII, who I don't think spent much time in his own country. But I wonder whether that link actually with Europe, which I think is fundamental, will be lost with Prince William. Do we know if Prince William can speak other languages, for instance?
I don't. Do you, Hugo?
No, not particularly. I don't particularly know whether he can or not. The Queen spoke quite good French, not absolutely as good as people said it was. But of course, she also did come out with that wonderful remark, you know, we drive on different sides of the road, but we're both going in the same direction.
And what are your expectations of Charles as a man?
I think that we got a lot from that first address on the 9th of September when he declared, you know, that he wasn't going to be doing the sort of things that he'd done before as Prince of Wales. He felt he was very free to say what he thought, and I actually completely support that because people don't have to listen to him if they don't want to. As king, his public statements will all be approved by the government. We've had an example already that he didn't go to the COP meeting because Liz Truss said he wasn't to go. He accepted that completely. He can do a lot of things behind the scenes. I think he'll be a very substantial monarch, actually.
Paul, what's your estimate?
Yes, I think he will. He certainly had a substantial apprenticeship, I think. Going back to what Annie was saying, though, about this difference between France and Britain and perhaps a European thing, I think this goes quite deep in the modern monarchy and the constitution that we have here, in the sense that France is an Enlightenment project. It is an a priori kind of reasoned project. It's something that should work. Whereas I think Britain, and we think of like Descartes being the kind of philosophical architect of that idea. In England, in Britain, it's Locke, it's John Locke, the empirical. It's looking at what does work. And I think what we've seen is that the monarchy does work. It does bring stability. I see all the virtues and all the rationality of republicanism, but I'm not sure it works quite as well. And when I see Trump in particular, I'm not sure that I want that power invested in the head of state. I'm quite happy with Charles. I think he's a man who seems to be engaged with people. I think the relationship between him and Camilla has become quite an engaging one, and they seem quite popular. I think as long as he does have that idea of duty, which he seems to accept, discretion, maybe there's more problematic there, I don't know, but certainly he's brought dignity to it so far. And it bodes well as far as I can see, but history, you never know.
My final question is, how many more coronations do you think there will be in the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland? What do you think, Hugo?
Oh, yes, I'm sure there will be. They'll change each time. Of course, we are losing quite a lot with this coronation. Maybe we had to keep things going. A lot of the traditions have been dropped and it's very hard to bring them back again. Maybe people don't want to. But I'm sure that in the fullness of time, Prince William will take his place. He's going to be playing quite a big role in this coronation. And, of course, even Prince George, the next heir in line, is going to be getting his first shot at the thing by being one of the King's pages of honour and helping to carry his train. So he'll be very prominent on this occasion too.
And yes, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the years of Charles on the throne is also the years of Prince William learning how to become king in probably not so long a time. Charles has very good genes, so, you know, perhaps he will be king for another 20 years. But still, it will come very fast, much faster than with Queen Elizabeth. And I will be watching how, you know, Prince William learn, because I have the feeling that there will be really a big difference, a generational gap between Charles and William, something that we won't have between Elizabeth and Charles, if you'd like. I mean, the coronation itself might be 2 hours long instead of almost 4 hours, but I think William will be a big change.
Yes, there does seem to have been a fairly smooth transition from Elizabeth to Charles, and it may be that the big division will be in 20 years' time or so. What do you think, Paul? Do you think that the royal family can go on as they are going on? We heard Princess Anne saying in an interview for the coronation that the only purpose of the royal family was to support the monarch. Is the show viable long term?
I don't know, is the truth. It depends on a lot of factors. One is the continuation of the UK, for example. I suspect if there is questions over it in Scotland, which seems to have become more republican over time. I don't know to what extent or not. My biggest fear would be this turning our back on the magic, in a way, to hyper-rationalise, constantly questioning idea, constantly questioning society that simply can't accept hierarchy, doesn't want hierarchy, doesn't even want hierarchy in a symbolic sense, and certainly doesn't want one that is informed by religion, a religion that people are turning away from in ever greater numbers. So that would be my biggest fear, that perhaps we end up with a sort of rather lukewarm monarchy as one gets in, say, Belgium or the Netherlands, or maybe a Scandi style. I don't know. But I don't also see any great demand for a president or that kind of head of state.
Thanks indeed to Paul Lay, senior editor of Engelsberg Ideas, Agnès Poirier, journalist and author, and Hugo Vickers, royal biographer and author. You've been listening to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. Worldview is produced by Murray Jessel, Eve Webster and Alistair Benn, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.